The following program is being brought to you on the Voice America Business Channel. For more information about our network and to check our additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit voiceamericabusiness.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live internet talk radio. Visit voiceamerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the following program are strictly those of the host or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by the Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management.
Financial technology, or fintech, is one of the fastest-growing industries in the world today, with New York, London, Tel Aviv, Edinburgh, Singapore, Moscow, and other major cities all vying for a piece of the action. Welcome to Breaking Banks, the first dedicated radio show that focuses on how this new boom is changing everything, from the way we bank to the very concept of money itself. Now, here's your host, Brett King.
To Breaking Banks, we are live from the studio in New York today. I have in the studio with me Michael J. Casey.
Hello,
Michael,
there, Brett. Welcome. Thanks for having me.
For those that don't know you, Michael, you are at the MIT Media Lab working on blockchain. You also have written previously for Wall Street Journal. You're the author of the
Age of Cryptocurrency.
The Age of Cryptocurrency. My apologies for forgetting that at the moment. And welcome to the studio and joining us today.
Pleasure to be here.
We do have a show. We're going to be talking a lot about blockchain and Bitcoin and that sort of stuff today. We haven't done that for a while. It's good to have Michael, who's an authority on this, in the studio. But just before we get to that, just a quick couple of things. Just some news. For those of you been watching, our friend Shamir Karkal. Shamir has just returned to BBVA as the head of Open API, so we're going to have him on the show in a few weeks to talk about what that means. I was chatting with him earlier in the week. They're not quite ready to sort of talk about the commercial aspects of that, but he'll be on. But also the Millennial Disruption Index, if you see some of the research on that, 73% millennials would be more excited about a new offering in financial services from Google, Amazon, Apple, or PayPal. So what does that mean? Well, if you look at the actual metrics on take-up of mobile wallets right now, mobile wallets outnumber bank accounts globally by 2-1. So can we really argue that mobile payments aren't yet at scale? Well, it doesn't seem so. Bank Innovation Challenge last week, it came down biometrics versus blockchain. SayPay took the top honor, so we might try and get them on the show. And just a couple of quick announcements. Finovate, we've got FinDeva coming up, focusing on the technology aspects of FinTech. New York City, March 29th, and Finovate Spring, of course, San Jose, May 10th and 11th. And don't forget, of course, NextBank USA on May 12th in Silicon Valley. JP Nichols, who's one of the co-hosts, will be there helping run that. So let's jump straight into it. On the line from Ohio is Jim Morales. I guess you're in Ohio today, are you, Jim?
I am in Ohio. I was in Salt Lake City for about 4 days, and now I'm back in Ohio.
Okay, so I saw you came up with some interesting research. Obviously, you do the digital banking report. Is that quarterly?
It's actually a monthly. We do it about 9 to 10 times a year, so it's about every 6 weeks.
All right, so guys just did a new version of the digital banking report, and I love the way you tweeted it out about the marketing insanity of banks. What were you getting at there in terms of the report? What were the conclusions you came to?
Yeah, Brett. The most recent digital banking report was a survey of about 270 banks and credit unions in the U.S., and what we found was startling. What wasn't startling was that it appears that most retail bankers and retail bank marketers understood what the challenges were. They understood that that measuring results of their marketing programs are important. There's too many initiatives. They talk about the need to have improved data analytics and advanced analytics, and that they need to have marketing personalization. The big challenge, and the reason why we tweeted out about the insanity, is that while they know these things, they're ranked as a priority very, very low, and there's no money being put against it. So some of the findings we found was that while 47% of the largest banks found that advanced analytics were a top priority, only 8% of the smaller banks, community banks and credit unions, felt the same way. And even though they thought it was a top priority, the reality was that it was bottom of the totem pole when it came to investment. So we tend to talk a good game but don't implement very well. On top of that, we see that what we found was that 35% of the financial institutions are going to increase their branch networks in 2016, while only 15% said they're going to decrease their networks. Now, we didn't cross-tap it to find out, you know, which institutions are bigger or smaller, but what that says is, despite the fact that we're getting lower and lower transactions, the financial institutions are still building branches, which is another one of those disconnects. We also found that about 50% of the institutions would allocate 50% or more to offline channels, while 82% would spend less than 20% on online. So what that says is, even though we know that digital communication channels are the way to go, financial institutions are doing a very poor job of catching up to the marketplace on every digital metric that there would be. So it's you know, it was very disappointing, I guess. Not necessarily surprising, but disappointing that it appeared to us that banks are continually taking last year's strategic plan and simply updating it with tweaks for the next year, as opposed to really throwing the whole thing out and starting from scratch and having it reflect what the consumer wants right now.
So you had a great anecdote the other day about a millennial who had decided to leave their credit union. Do you want to say that? Because I think that's
It was interesting. I sat down with somebody who at a banking conference, and they said, you know, they had been banking with their same credit union for years, and their parents had also. And she said that it got to the point where the friendliness, which is still the term that credit unions tend to use quite a bit, while the credit unions said, you know, the friendliness was there and all that, but the millennial said, yes, we're friendly. And she says, you know, I love working with them, but they're just not getting it with regard to mobile banking and digital banking. So what's happening right now is there's a disconnect, and J.D. Power found this too, that, as you know, the most recent J.D. Power survey said that for the first time ever, the big banks had a higher satisfaction rate. And while the big banks were not ranked very high with regard to certain things like fees and things like that, they were ranked very high with regards to mobile banking and digital banking. So what ends up happening is the consumer, millennials, are making decisions based on other things, and advocacy is being viewed in more ways than simply, are you friendly? What we're finding now is that when I probed further, she said, well, what's interesting is it all makes sense that this is happening with me. But she goes, my parents are going to be leaving the bank also for the same reason. So it's, you know, as I keep on saying, you know, most millennials are digitals, but that does not mean that most digitals are all millennials. And I think we're finding that there's a cross-section across all demographic groups of people who really rely on the digital components of banking, and they're moving their wallet right now. They're moving their business based on more things than simply, was my bank friendly? I think a big problem is the fact that, you know, the friendliness is only an in-person friendliness in many cases. And if people aren't going to the branches, they're not seeing that. So there's a lot of things that are offsetting that.
Well, you know, I'm not sure what we have to do to move the needle on this. We've been talking about this pretty significantly, but, you know, for months, for years, we've been talking about these issues with credit unions and banks. I don't know when they're going to get it, but anyway, where can people get a copy of the report?
They can go to onlinebankingreport.com, you can also connect with me on my Twitter account at Jim Marous, M-A-R-O-U-S. It's my handle, but I think we have a big challenge, because I think while everybody kind of knows what's going on and talks to it good, I think we're finding that the implementation against what is happening is not at all up to speed.
Well, I think, you know, and we'll ask Chris Skinner about this in a moment, because he's coming on to talk about his new book. But I think, you know, the real challenge is everyone knows this is going to happen, But and while there's some mobilization around innovation teams and startups and so forth, when you have like mid-range and smaller credit unions, the ability to, for them to change the way they work from a physical process, paperwork, based, service in, is the branch sort of mentality or culture, to move that needle is very, very hard. So as digital behaviors become more and more prominent, then you're going to see that you've got to see that service gap open up, right?
Well, you said it before too, Brett, that the marketing department needs to have data scientists. We did a survey, more of an ad hoc survey recently in a very large group of bankers and said, give us an idea of what your marketing team looks like. And 90% of them have mostly advertising executives, PR executives, and product marketers. And less than 5% had what they would consider to be digitally astute players on their team. We won't get there from a standpoint of personalization, communication, the ability to address the consumer's need for communication via the digital channels if we don't have the skill sets in place. And it's getting to be more and more of an acute problem.
Digital should already make up 50% of marketing and 50% of channel spend. If that's not the case, then your budget's already wrong. Anyway, we've got Ron.
The challenge, I'll tell you, at the survey across the board, I think that the category that was probably the furthest behind was the, and it's broad categorization, but the credit unions are at least making some attempts on across the board, and especially the large ones. But the community banks seem to really be challenged, and they have a lot of challenges. It costs more for them to do business. They have, obviously, compliance issues that they have to spend towards. But they seem to be the category of banks that are really being are falling farther and farther behind what the consumers expected.
And no one said it was easy, Jim, but, anyway, thanks for joining us on the show today, Jim, and we'll be sure to keep watching out for the Digital Banking Report.
Thanks very much, Brett.
No problem. Okay, so we'd like to invite a regular on the show and also someone who looks after hosting duties from time to time, Chris Skinner. Welcome back to Breaking Banks.
Hey, Brett. How are you doing?
Good. So, ostensibly, we wanted to get you on the show today to talk about actually your new book. I mean, rather than you playing host today, you've got your new Value Web coming out. Now, it's coming out in a week, right?
Yeah, in the UK, in the US, it comes out in early April.
Okay, great. So tell us a bit about the book. And this seems to be a little bit of a departure from the stuff that you've written on in the past. So I'm quite excited to hear about what's the Value Web and where you've taken this.
Well, the last book was Digital Bank, which is how to digitalize an existing bank or launch a new digital neobank. This book's more about the reason why, which is because of fintech and all the stuff that you talk about on the show and that we're seeing at Money 2020 and fintech conferences and discussions around the world. And in particular, it's talking about how embedded chips in the Internet of Things give us connectivity between not just peer-to-peer, person-to-person, but thing-to-thing, machine-to-machine. And once you have that, how are they going to transact? Well, they need some form of low-cost value exchange system, which might be a digital exchange system that's not even currency based. It could be airtime minutes, and in particular a lot about shared ledgers. And I'm not going to say blockchain because I get told off by some colleagues if I say blockchain because they think it means Bitcoin blockchain, and shared ledgers is nothing to do with Bitcoin blockchain. It's to do with the private structures that banks are creating in order to have provenance and proof that something happened at a certain date and time between two individuals. And that's a really exciting area that's transforming not just banking but governance and the whole nature of legal and global structures.
Absolutely. So actually Michael and I were having this very same discussion in terms of how. Hey Jim, can you just put your line on mute, is that okay? Michael, this problem that we have around blockchain being associated with Bitcoin, that Chris is talking about, how do you think we break the back of that?
Oh, so I don't necessarily, am I on? Okay. I don't necessarily agree that you could say it has nothing to do with Bitcoin. I think it's very hard to actually, certainly in terms of the genesis of the idea and the history, and sometimes even the structure of the shared ledgers that are being built. A lot of them are built with the same basic primitives on which Bitcoin was built. So just to get that out there. But certainly there's a lot of different banks looking at shared ledgers that would not need a cryptocurrency as the incentive tool, and there's a big and ongoing debate about how much of a shift that is. Nonetheless, the very idea of a shared ledger and a distributed form of proving transactions is going to be absolutely critical to Chris's point about, you know, in this Internet of Things world. It's just, I think that the way I like to think about it is, you know, right now, cloud computing, which is one way we could imagine the transactions that would happen in an IoT world being managed, is very much dominated by Amazon, right? So Amazon suddenly becomes effectively a giant too-big-to-fail bank if we have to run and coordinate transactions across that sort of setting in a way where they are the ones that are proving the ledger. It's just absolutely untenable, right? So whatever needs to happen, it has to be a very robust form of distributed technology. And I think this is going to be a huge debate, because I don't know in something that is as diverse and as decentralized and sort of multitudinous as a Internet of Things world with so many different devices, who and what gets to decide the structure of that shared ledger? What are the who are the validators? Who's behind it? Those are going to be very, very important questions.
So, Chris, what was your take on that issue? How do we get from where we are today, which is a very structured environment, central banks, regulation, to this environment, which is going to be a lot more dynamic?
Yeah, I mean, the core essence of what's happening is it's not just shared ledgers, but the combination of cloud and analytics means that the back office infrastructures of the financial system are being completely reimagined by internet open source technologies. Combine that with APIs and great user experience at the front end with mobile and IoT, and you've got this new generation of an internet of value that's arising. Now, the core point when we say shared ledger is who's sharing that ledger, and that's going to be the big challenge over the next cycle of not just the next 12 months, but probably the next 5 years, which is, are we creating another SWIFT? Are we creating another Visa, MasterCard? Do we need such a structure? And if so, who's going to be owning that structure, to Michael's point? And it has been spawned by the concepts of Satoshi Nakamoto's paper for the Bitcoin protocol and blockchain, Bitcoin blockchain, but the reason why I'm separating it is to say what the banks are doing is creating a private ledger system rather than the public ledger system. And the big banks, particularly with the R3 consortia, for example, 42 banks, Digital Asset Holdings that has 13 companies, a lot of banks involved, are creating the new structures today. What then is going to be interesting is what the mid-sized community banks, regional banks, and smaller banks do, because they're going to have no influence over this.
It's absolutely critical, and I think, in fact, it calls for a very big public debate, because at the end of the day, we're talking about, you know, a bunch of banks who may well decide on the future infrastructure here, and that could just be yet another form of too big to fail risk. It could be a too big to fail blockchain or too big to fail distributed ledger. So I think we all have a very big public interest in what shape this infrastructure takes. And I do hope that the conversation moves on. This is not to suggest that R3 or anybody is doing anything nefarious, or they haven't got the broader interests of financial stability in mind. But I think that there is a risk that I see coming from the rhetoric out of the banks right now, that they are confined by a paradigm that is going to go away. So when I hear the banks talk about the regulatory obligations that they face and the processes that they need to carry out, there's a bit of a circular argument, because those regulatory obligations and processes were defined
in place to protect from the inadequacies of
the existing system. So, you know, if we're going to change all that, then you don't need these. So you can't use that as your excuse to build, you know, very narrow versions of what could be possible. And I think some of the private blockchains, you know, most of the articles I read right now,
it replicates
right.
The same.
They're getting narrower and narrower, the definition of what they think could happen. And
which
I think
avoids
that,
the whole distributed.
Right, but the world's going to change, because IoT is coming and all this sort of stuff is going to put a lot of pressure.
The whole idea was to get rid of the middleman, but the middleman's fighting back.
Right. Absolutely.
Right, listen, guys, let's have a quick break. And then, Chris, I want to come back after the break and get a little bit more info on the book, but also talk about the new fund you're starting. So you're listening to Breaking Banks. I'm your host, Brett King. We have Michael Casey in the office here, in the studio here in New York, and we've got Chris Skinner live from London. Before we head to the break, Thank you to Temenos for their sponsorship. If you want to check Jam in Miami on March 10th, I'll be there speaking about my new book, Augmented. Back after the short break.
Your world to look like in 2030. This is Rachel Morrissey, the producer of Breaking Banks, and we are joining the UN Global Goals Initiative and participating in Radio Everyone this week from September 25th to October 2nd. Global Goals is a 15-year plan to address 17 specific goals to end poverty, fight inequality, and fix climate change. To find out more about Global Goals and Radio Everyone, go to www.globalgoals.org.
When you're looking for the right place to eat, there's an app for that. When you need directions getting there, there's an app for that. And if you're trying to make a healthy choice, there's an app for that. But what about an app that tells you how you're doing with your money? Now, there's an app for that. It's called Moovin, a free app and debit account that automatically tracks your spending. You get real-time feedback with every purchase you make and a debit account with no overdraft or monthly fees. So if you want to stay on track with your money, download the Moovin app for free on iPhone or Android and check out Moovin.com. That's M-O-V-E-N.com.
Today, make that long overdue call to your bank and thank them. Thank them for a checking account, one that has a minimum balance and penalties for going below it. Thank them for a savings account, one that has almost no interest and charges statement fees to let you know it. Most of all, thank them for overdraft fees and all those other fees you never even knew existed. Thank them today. Why? Because the future of banking is here, and it's not just what you want, it's what you deserve. Moovin is a free app and debit card with no overdraft, ATM, or monthly fees. Best of all, you get an instant receipt every time you make a purchase, and daily feedback on your spending so you can always be on top of your money. So make that call to your bank and say thanks, but no thanks. And when you're done, download the free app and get Moovin today.
Business community's first choice in Internet Talk Radio, Voice America Business Network.
You're listening to Breaking Banks featuring your host, Brett King. To reach the show today, please call 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. Or join the conversation on Twitter by using the hashtag Breaking Banks. Now, back to the program.
Back to Breaking Banks. I am your host, Brett King. You can follow the discussion on Twitter today. Use the hashtag Breaking Banks, and we'll see if we can put your questions to the the commentators and guests on the show. And also, if you want to check out the previous episodes, of course, go to breakingbanks.com, or you can get us on iTunes, Stitcher, Podcaster, SoundCloud, etc. If you want to see some of the other stuff. Now we got Brock Pierce, who's the managing with Blockchain Capital and the chair of the Bitcoin Foundation. Brock, welcome back to the show. And you got Bart Stevens with you as well. Bart, welcome.
Brad, I also appreciate being on the show with my partner, Brock Pierce.
No problem. So we're going to get into talking about sort of the capital environment around blockchain and so forth in a moment and get you guys. I also want to talk about Core versus Classic, which I'm sure you're talking a lot about that at the moment. But before we get to that, Chris, you're also starting, you've gone from the value web position. Now you're looking at putting together a fund in Europe. Can you give us a little bit more information about that? I know it's very early, but...
Yeah, I mean, I've been... writing about Bitcoin for 5 years now, and then as the banks got excited about shared ledgers and what came out of the Bitcoin blockchain, I also got excited and realized that this is a fundamental transformation of the way in which we'll exchange value because we're making it open source and internet based. And when the book was coming at fruition, I got approached from two different directions. One was from a friend of mine in mainland Europe who said, you ought to go and create a fintech fund. Can I come and join you and work on creating that with you? And this guy's been formerly a senior vice president in one of the big European banks. I then also got invited to the advisory board of a fintech venture capital fund. And they said, you know, we'd like you to join us. And then as these things came together and the book, I kind of said, well, you know what, we should really think about creating a banking on blockchain fund, because there isn't a go-to fund right now for blockchain startup use case companies in the financial markets. There's funds that do fintech. There are venture funds like Brocks that are heavily involved in Bitcoin blockchain. But this is a specific area of developing investment for and on behalf of the banking community in the main areas where we see opportunity in shared ledgers, such as in clearing and settlement, in supply chain and trade finance, in digital identity and in payments. And the banks at the moment have a problem, which is that in each of those areas, let's say clearing and settlement, you've got a large number of startup companies. Some of them might do well, but eventually one or two will be the winners. So you've got Digital Asset Holdings, Clearmatics, Overstock, Settle, Epiphyte, you know, lots of companies doing stuff. Which one do you invest in? And the aim of the fund is that on behalf of the banking community, and we'll get the funds from the banking community, which we've already got 15 million between soft and hard commitments in the fund, to invest in the best use cases in finance. So of those 10 or 12 companies in clearing and settlement, maybe three or four will be the ones that we'll put the money into.
Interesting, interesting. So we're coming back to the book, ValueWeb, though. Where can people, and in the subtitle, I like, it's how fintech firms are using mobile and blockchain technologies to create the internet of value. So where can we'll order your new book, Chris?
It's going to be everywhere, and particularly all over my blog, but equally it'll be on Amazon, Google, Apple, whatever you use, electronic, hardback versions. And I got the first pre-releases a couple of weeks ago and discovered that it's 33% bigger than Digital Bank for the same price. So there you go, you get a third free.
You, value.
And also, I should say, Brock Pierce is one of the star case studies in the book and is one of the really good guys in this space, so I appreciate his input.
Awesome. Well, Brock, welcome back to the show, and thanks, Chris. You stick around if you've got some questions or you want to had input into the discussion. Then
yeah, sure.
So, Brock, welcome back.
Again, thank you for having me.
No problem. So, you know, we seem to be at this interesting sort of juncture in the life of Bitcoin. You know, blockchain is taking off like mad, but you know, Bitcoin sort of becoming less important in that discussion from an infrastructure perspective. And we've recently had this core versus classic battle that's taken place. So maybe to start this discussion off, for those that, because we've got a lot of people that listen to the show on AM band, for example, and may not understand the intricacies of this issue, can you explain what has been the issue recently in terms of the Bitcoin, Bitcoin infrastructure, in terms of this core versus classic movement? Can we start with that?
Yeah, so the blockchain I like to describe as the operating system, and Bitcoin was the first application. You now have about 650, maybe 700 blockchains in the world that are all, you know, modified or slightly different from Bitcoin in some way, or perhaps radically different, and they with different attributes. In the case of Bitcoin, it's got about 80% of the called overall market share of blockchains today, and all Bitcoin's blockchain, not all of them are designed this way, are built on open source software type architecture. Meaning that you've got lots of people that are developing the Bitcoin blockchain software. They're making their proposals as to what they think is the best way to scale it. And so this debate has ensued because Bitcoin is suffering from its own success. It's growing exponentially. Most people look at the price as the primary barometer of sentiment. And Bitcoin went up to $1,000. It's now trading in the low to mid 400s. And so if that's the only data point you look at, you might think that, you know, perhaps Bitcoin is failing. But if you look a layer deeper and you look at all the fundamental metrics, It's growing, you know, at 40% month over month all over the world, you know, specifically in developing countries that where it has its greatest utility, you know, Latin America, Africa, Southeast Asia, you know, places where you've got 5+ billion people around the world that belong to that category of on or underbanked. And so Bitcoin needs to continue to evolve its software so that it can handle the amount of transactional volume that's coming through it. So this debate started, there was one of the core developers put forward a proposal and said, I think we should do this. The rest of the development community said, oh, we don't like your idea. We think that's not the right way. We want to do that. And, you know, he had written a blog post that created a, you know, a bunch of sort of drama within the community. And you have essentially two groups of developers now that have formed. One, which is referred to as Bitcoin Core, another that is referred to as Bitcoin Classic. And they're just two competing proposals as to how to scale Bitcoin. And I think it's a good thing that you've got, you know, lots of people thinking hard, and these are very, very smart people. I don't want to weigh in as to what I think is best, because quite frankly, the people that are doing this are far smarter than I am in terms of being great developers and cryptographers and mathematicians and the things that you need to do to build this type of software. The problem is financial markets really, really dislike uncertainty, and this has created a lot of uncertainty in our market. But I think it's a very healthy thing. Again, open source software development is a place where everyone gets to put forward the best ideas. It runs through a peer review type process. And the only problem is it's very public. Everyone gets to see how the sausage is made, and it just isn't very pretty. I hope that summarizes what's happening here. And as the chairman of the Bitcoin Foundation and a person that has invested heavily in the companies or the infrastructure called the bridges, the roads, and the tunnels for that ecosystem, as well as a large holder of Bitcoin, I hope we find a solution to this problem, and that good problem to have, meaning it's scaling, it's becoming a victim of its own success. I hope we find a solution soon.
It's a common way we see that victim of its own success is with transaction lag. Would that be correct?
Yeah, I don't think there's much there in the way of transaction lag, though there is a risk that that will start to become a problem over the course of the next months or the next year. There's been some instances of that, but I don't think it's impacted really. I mean, if you use Bitcoin on a regular basis, that I do, I personally haven't had any issues using Bitcoin. The transaction lag is the way that Bitcoin's transactions get prioritized is based upon paying fees. You know, I'm using wallets and things that typically have I haven't encountered any lag personally that has, you know, created delays in anything I've attempted to do. Though they are happening, but it's not yet a problem that I think is burdening the ecosystem in a way that's going to turn anyone off just yet. But that's the reason why it's become a big deal, and you're seeing all this media about it. We have to, like Facebook or any, you know, great company or application that is, you know, being adopted in, you know, in mass, and it's scaling rapidly. You know, you have to figure out how to scale that infrastructure to make sure that it can continue to support the users and all the things that they want to do.
You know, one thing I think is interesting, this is Michael here, just to put in perspective about why there is a challenge here is that, you know, unlike an open source project that doesn't involve money. You know, we're talking about a market cap, you know, in advance of, you know, $6.5 billion here. There's an enormous amount at stake. And so, you know, that's one of the reasons why there are big divisions, because people have a lot of skin in the game, and they really want to make sure that they don't lose that money. So that can be thought of as a negative, because it does constrain the governance. It does mean it's difficult to make, you know, big progressive changes, because there's so much at stake. On the other hand, what's good about that is that everybody cares. So you really have an absolute dedication, even if these people are divided on either side, to get this thing right. There is so much money at stake that it has this sort of positive feedback loop in terms of how robust this open source project is going to be. And I think people forget that when they say, oh, I can just go and build my own private blockchain and it will scale perfectly. They're possibly right, but how many bugs are going to be in that? The bugs are possibly less significant in something that's tapping such a large community of very, very invested people as Bitcoin is.
Yeah, so maybe, Bart, I'll ask you a question here. you know, as an investor in the space, do you guys have a position in terms of, you know, how you'd like to see this resolve?
We don't take a position publicly. You know, Blockchain Capital is one of the most active investors in the Bitcoin and blockchain ecosystem. We've invested tens of millions of dollars in 42 companies over 3 years. So we essentially have a bunch of conflicts of interest that potentially you know, puts us in a position where we kind of can't take sides. But I'd just like to echo Brock's comments that, you know, this is essentially an outgrowth of a very robust ecosystem in terms of the quality of entrepreneurs and developers that are involved is very high. There's been over $1 billion of venture capital invested in this sector, and so the stakes are high. And so, you know, we see competition as a healthy thing, but we also think that with the stakes being so high, you do want to be careful when you're making fundamental changes to the system, whether that's the code base or the governance. So we've got lots of friends and companies on both sides, but we're pretty confident that this will be resolved in short order.
Yeah, so the community has, I mean, they've shown in the past their ability to solve these problems, so hopefully. But so let me ask you guys a little bit of a question from left field. We've seen this week a lot of talk about UK, about encryption in messaging platforms, and we've, of course, seen the Department of Justice, FBI action against Apple, trying to get them to unlock a bunch of iPhones here. So where is the role of blockchain? And Chris, you might have an opinion here. What's the role of blockchain in resolving some of these issues moving forward as we move away from sort of this traditional infrastructure of a value store, an identity tied to a specific value store, which is held in a bank vault?
I believe security is a fundamental human right. I mean, that puts it simply as far as I'm concerned.
Okay, Chris?
Yeah, I was just going to throw in that one of the big areas and use cases for shared ledgers is based on blockchain technologies, is digital identity. And you can't have an Internet of Things if you don't have a digital identity structure. And what that really means is that you've got to have some way of saying, these are my things, they're authorized to transact on my behalf, and this phone, this television, this car, this house, this pair of shoes, have certain rules and structures around my identity that differentiates them from Brett's shoes and car and house and fridge, you know. So it really is going to be intriguing as we move forward as to how that develops, because to a large extent, and the Apple case is a great illustration of going after the wrong thing, in my view. There's a really good Medium post about, you know, cracking down on Apple when we let the gun control in America go out of control, but let's not get into that political debate. What it really says is, and it's to the point we just made, that my security of my identity is going to be a critical factor. Now, if I can secure that and have provenance and trust in my identity in a digital form, then we could transform pretty much everything in the world that we deal with today, because everything could be digitalized. All the legal structures, all the government structures, all the financial structures could be digitalized through an open source internet structure if we had a secure and trusted digital identity managed through some form of shared scheme. The problem is that any scheme that we come up with could have a fatal flaw, and that's going to take a long time to be resolved. You know, David Birch, who's also been on your show, Brett, you know, is one of the key exponents of digital identities, and you know, to solve that one is not a simple problem, but I think we might get there in the next decade through shared ledgers.
So, Michael, let me ask you this question. You know, Brock had a really great description of Bitcoin being the first application on top of blockchain, which is like the operating system. Love that illustration. So tell me about some of the other things that you're seeing at MIT Media Lab in terms of applications of the blockchain in areas that isn't Bitcoin.
Well, there's just innumerable ones. In fact, it's really been quite astounding for me to see all these ideas come in through the door. You know, we're a bit of a clearinghouse for research projects up there. I mean, I could just go anywhere. So, medical records is one that we've been focusing on, right? So, the blockchain, it, you know, could play a role in basically coordinating disparate databases that don't have a capacity to talk to each other. And rather than sort of like amalgamate them into a central database, you can use the blockchain to manage private keys that would be a permissions basis around which data becomes shared. So one could imagine, in the same way that we might also talk about managing our digital identities like this as well, taking control of our data. Right now, you know, medical data sits in hospitals or it sits at your insurer. It's all over the place, different pieces of it everywhere. I take control. I'm the one that permissions out pieces of this and yet creates it in a way that can be aggregated and none of the privacy concerns get raised out of it. So there's a lot of power that comes from that. Digital rights management. I mean, there's obviously a lot of applications in the financial sector, but we've already discussed some of those. I'm just going to sort of move it out of that. Copyright, for example, is a classic one. As Chris was saying before, we have this idea of the provenance of events and of transactions. Well, if we can think about the moment at which a piece of digital art or a book or anything has been established as having the copyright to a particular author and establish that as a transaction and then build a smart contract on top of that in which payments can be made for every derivative use of that, that's just one of the uses. There's a digital rights management, there's a digital identity management.
We talked about solar.
Well, we're talking here because I think the energy sector, we're talking about smart grids having to become incredibly complex, again, with an IoT component to that, and having to sort of figure out how we're going to manage the relationship between these houses and the public grid, or more importantly, in totally decentralized settings like off-grid places in the developing world, how would we place solar panels that might be given an asset registry on the blockchain, for example, and turned into a securitized asset, used in terms of a microgrid where the payment for over and under usage is actually regulated through a cryptocurrency, and then rolled into a large asset-backed security and sold higher up the chain as a form of kind of solar panel-backed securities. These are the kinds of ideas that we're toying around with up there, and we think there's an enormous amount of potential.
Well, Dave Birch, who's been a guest on the show regularly, just tweeted out the Birch Panifer Parulova model. I don't know how to say that. Which he said he doesn't think the OS analogy is quite right, so he tried to describe blockchain with a model. So if you're following the hashtag Breaking Banks, then you'll be able to see what he tweeted out, which I think is quite interesting. Listen, let's just have a quick break, guys. After the break, Brock, I'd like to get your opinions on Ethereum, which is pretty hot at the moment. And we'll also invite Jeremy Allaire from Circle on to talk about how they're doing. So we'll be right back after this quick break. This is Brett King, the host of Breaking Banks. We've got some exciting news for you. We've just joined with Radio Everyone and the United Nations on their Global Goals Initiative. Now, this is a 15-year plan to address 17 specific goals to end poverty, fight inequality, and fix climate change. So, Breaking Banks, we're planning a special episode on October the 1st to talk about the organizations around the world that are using fintech to increase financial inclusion, to eradicate poverty and reduce inequality. Join us at Breaking Banks and the team at Radio Everyone on the UN Global Goals Initiative to end poverty, fight inequality, and fix climate change.
Today, make that long overdue call to your bank and thank them. Thank them for a checking account, one that has a minimum balance and penalties for going below it. Thank them for a savings account, one that has almost no interest and charges statement fees to let you know it. Most of all, thank them for overdraft fees and all those other fees you never even knew existed. Thank them today. Why? Because the future of banking is here, and it's not just what you want, it's what you deserve. Moovin is a free app and debit card with no overdraft, ATM, or monthly fees. Best of all, you get an instant receipt every time you make a purchase and daily feedback on your spending so you can always be on top of your money. So make that call to your bank and say thanks, but no thanks. And when you're done, download the free app and get Moovin today.
Business community's first choice in Internet Talk Radio, Voice America Business Network.
listening to Breaking Banks featuring your host, Brett King. To reach the show today, please call 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. Or join the conversation on Twitter by using the hashtag Breaking Banks. Now, back to the program.
Guys, just before we get back to the blockchain discussion in Bitcoin, say a quick hello, Ron.
Hey, everybody. Good to be here.
Ron Shevlin just popped in the studio. He's sitting in today, watching us perform. Brock, just before the break, I was going to ask you guys, and Michael, you can jump in with your opinion. I'm sure you got an opinion. What do you guys think of Ethereum? Because they've been
it was at like, 97 cents on January 1st, and now it's about $9.37. 900 or 1,000% price increase with real liquidity. I mean, you see trading volumes of $10 to $20 million a day. My group, we invested 500 Bitcoin in the original crowd sale, which was called the 10-cent range. So obviously, quite happy as a result of that. Ethereum is one of the fantastic projects around blockchain technology today. To describe it simply, it's basically Bitcoin, but designed to enable this concept of smart contracts. I often describe the world is migrating from an environment where we've got legally binding sort of contracts to one that becomes technologically binding, and that's because as we start to digitize assets into this shared database or shared ledger technology, what happens is that they become digital assets. And when you digitize an asset, it enables the ability to program it. It becomes what we like to describe as smart property, where I can write rules into that dollar bill that says that dollar bill under XYZ set of circumstances transfers from me to you. But without anyone in the middle, it happens automatically. So I believe we're migrating from a world of legally binding sort of governance to technologically binding. The lawyers of the future are going to be programmers. And Ethereum is the blockchain that was designed to enable that, at least. It's by far the best way of doing that today. Though it's still, relatively early. Ethereum only started trading, and it's still essentially in an alpha or beta stage of development today.
I did like.
I would add, this is Bart. I would add two things about Ethereum. One is we're seeing increased entrepreneurial activity. Lots of talent is moving to the Ethereum ecosystem, and I think there's two factors to that. One is large financial institutions are intrigued with blockchain technology and, generally speaking, distributed ledgers, especially in the post-trade settlement world. But they have a problem with Bitcoin that has a bit of a PR problem due to some of its the salacious stories and misuse of Bitcoin in early days. So if you're a regulator or if you're a lawyer at a large bank, you might be interested in blockchain technology, but if it's a Bitcoin blockchain, you kind of have a problem. So we're increasingly seeing large financial institutions say, how can I take a look at distributed ledger technology on something that's not the Bitcoin blockchain? So I think that's part of what's feeding into the interest in Ethereum on behalf of large enterprises and financial institutions. And the other thing that's helping the Ethereum ecosystem we touched on earlier, and that is this notion of there is significant differences of opinion on how to scale the Bitcoin blockchain. And the core versus classic scaling and governance debates have created uncertainty. As Brock astutely mentioned earlier in the show, markets don't like financial uncertainty, and large banks and investment banks are major participants in these markets. So I think Ethereum is benefiting from some of the ongoing kind of self-inflicted wounds of the Bitcoin community.
Yeah, it's interesting. This aspect of this has meant that Ethereum is now bigger collectively than all the other altcoins. So that it's definitely now the logical successor to Bitcoin. But just before I get to you, Michael, Chris, you had a point on this as well, right?
Yeah, it's not necessarily the successor to Bitcoin. It's because the share price got a real kick upwards when the announcement came out that R3 is using Ethereum and Microsoft's Azure blockchain as a service. for the first use case large project of the 11 banks within the 42 bank network that it represents. So Credit Suisse, Barclays, HSBC, Commonwealth Bank of Australia, etc., are all going to be using Ethereum and Microsoft Azure for one of the first transaction systems that the banking network is using. When they announced that, then the market cap of Ethereum tripled. So that is actually the real kicker there.
All run by a 21-year-old Russian.
Amazing.
Vitalik Buterin. Yeah, we should get him on the show, actually.
You definitely should. Recommend anybody read up about the guy, because I remember hearing one of the guys in the Bitcoin community, Jeremy Gardner, say to me, he says, I don't know whether Ethereum is going to succeed or not, but I do know that Vitalik Buterin will go down as one of the greatest people of the 21st century.
Wow.
And I don't think that that's an exaggeration. I mean, the thing that this kid built, about it. It's an operating system for the global economy. He came up with this, and he dropped out of college to do it.
Right? Yeah, we had him at Cybos InnoTribe a couple of years ago. The kid's super smart.
Yeah. He's
wickedly smart.
Quite a brain.
All right. So, hey, Jeremy. So, Jeremy Allaire, welcome back to the show.
Thank you.
I thought I'd better get you in because we're just going to continue talking about this and we're going to run out of time. So give us an update on Circle and also where you fall in terms of this, the Bitcoin evolution.
Yeah, sure. So a few things. Circle launched late last year. We launched our more mainstream product, which is our apps and web service that allow people to share value, send and receive payments as a free service on the internet. The model uses traditional currencies, but marries it with the blockchain and marries it with digital currency platforms underneath to provide for a model for value exchange that is not another walled garden. And so when we started the company, we really believed that over the next 5 to 10 years, that in particular within retail finance or retail banking, that the payment utility component of what banks provide, which is some secure storage mechanism for value, which we all know today is essentially databases, and then utilities to move value in and out of that storage, that would entirely move to the internet and would just be a free service, just like communicating over the internet's free and sharing content over the internet's free. And we saw that blockchain technology was going to, I think, evolve to be akin to HTTP or SMTP or SMS or other distributed decentralized protocols that no government controls, no corporation controls, but the collective planet can build on and integrate with. And so we wanted to build a product that allowed consumers to have that kind of benefit, but with money. And so we launched that late in the year, last year. To do that, we needed to be licensed to hold a government-issued currency, to exchange it, convert it, facilitate payments with it, send it cross-border.
Payments.
And that was a tall order in that we needed to also get regulators comfortable with using the Bitcoin network as the open settlement network underneath that for moving value around. And so we've been very successful in doing that. The product's growing very fast. We are getting great usage, growing usage throughout the U.S., and people are using it for payments over the blockchain globally. But a lot of it is also just sort of native to Circle. So Circle is really becoming a much more open, global, cross-platform alternative to products like Venmo or Square Cash, which are products that are known domestically. But there isn't really yet a kind of Skype for money that's available globally that consumers can use with their local currencies to exchange value. And that's really what we've been off building, and we're seeing great consumer traction.
I'm glad you didn't say the Uber of money. You said Skype for me. Uber. So anyway, so just quickly, Brock, before we wrap up the show, because we've only a few minutes, what should we be looking out for? What's hot in terms of investment, going to be hot for investment this year in terms of blockchain, Bitcoin, altcoins, and so forth?
I think most of it is it's not sexy. It's not going to be the consumer-facing sort of side of this. I mean, I talked to... in the developing world, maybe. I think the developed world, I often have this conversation where it's like, hey, why should I be interested in Bitcoin? The skeptics approach me all the time, and they're like, why should I care about this? Explain it to me right now. And I'm like, you shouldn't. Not really for you. And then they're like, what do you mean it's not for me? Why is it for me? I say, well, let me guess. You've got a bank account. They're like, yeah. You got a piece of plastic in your pocket that lets you conveniently pay for things? They're like, I do. I go, you got rule of law that's here in theory to protect you, and most of the time it will. You got faith in the system, and of the 200 currencies in the world, you've got one that everyone wants more of. So I think most of the user adoption and the growth in the sector is going to come in sort of B2B use cases. It's the underlying plumbing of transactions. Well, we as consumers aren't going to see it. Businesses like Abra, are trying to change the way that money is remitted. But as a consumer, you'll never hear the word Bitcoin, but it's running on Bitcoin and blockchain-based technologies. And that's going to be around the big remittance corridors, you know, India to the Middle East or the Philippines to migrant workers moving money around the world that might be paying 10 or 20% fees. And these are the people that need the discounts more than anyone. Every dollar to them is materially affecting their lives. So I don't think it's going to be any of the sort of sexy consumer stuff. It's all going to be back-end sort of plumbing, much in the same way that we went from making our phone calls over twisted copper wires to voice over IP. But we, the consumers, never realized or recognized or saw that transition when it occurred. I think blockchain technology is going to be doing a lot of that. So it's not like there's one killer app. It's just creating efficiency everywhere.
Okay, so just in a couple of minutes we got left before we break, Michael, what do you think about the role of central banks? And
right. Yes. The big one to watch, I mean, similar to Brock's point, this is not something that's going to be coming at us from a necessary consumer perspective, but the stuff Brock's talking about is profound, but I would argue this is even more profound. If central banks move to issue their own digital currencies on the blockchain, the impact that could have on banks, which rely upon the idea that we use them for our short-term money and not central bank money, is profound. And we've got the Bank of England, we have the PBOC, we have the RBA from Australia. Lots of central banks now discussing this as an issue. And I think it could, in fact, be one of the things that creates a zeitgeist, if you like, within the demand for banking reform.
Great. Well, it's been a fantastic show. Bart Stevens, Brock Pierce from Blockchain Capital, thanks for having us.
Thank you. Thank you for having us.
And Chris, thank you for joining us and talking about ValueWeb.
Yo, my friend, anytime.
Absolutely. So check it out on Amazon.com, ValueWeb, Chris Skinner's new book out next month. Actually, this month and next month if you're in the US. To everyone else, thanks for joining the show again. Sorry we've run out of time, but it's been a fantastic show. I will see you on Breaking Banks again next week. Bye.
You've been listening to Breaking Banks with host Brett King. Please be sure to join us again next Thursday at noon Pacific Time, 3 p.m. Eastern Time, for more of the latest in fintech news.